6th Day of Freedom Day Retreat 2017. One of the reasons I have to do long retreats with other people, there are two really, are there many? Anyway, two for now. One is that it's always good for someone who does interviews and koan work to do koan work with somebody else. Not only do they shake up your precious style and remind you how it feels to be on the wrong foot, but it's also getting used to sitting without having talks to prepare. There's something about knowing that you're going to give a talk that means that you're sort of pigeonholing little thoughts as they come. Oh, I could use that. Oh, that would go with this. And this would be nice. And I could use that koan. That style of thinking. It's quite seductive because you think you're being brilliant and helping people. God, talk about delusion. So after breakfast I go and I put all these nicely pigeonholed things in a row, and then by the time we come in together, something has changed it all anyway. But that's part of the process, that's part of my practice, part of my respect for the people I practice with. Part of my kind of don't know practice. One of the ways the attachment self works is that it believes itself. It believes itself. Anyway. For some reason that struck me as I walked into the Zendo, which upset all my previous plans. There's something, it convinces itself that this is all there is. And it tells us, in the most believable, convincing way, that this is what I am. I am confused. I am a person of opinion. I am this. Or there's a good reason for this and there's a good reason for that. It builds up an edifice of compelling argument for being the way I am. And it does two things. It makes me a bit pompous and resistant to anything else. It also, in a strange way, undermines my confidence. It makes me more brittle in a way. The confidence in the wider self that I sometimes am. And what koan work does is that it takes sort of thinking problems, as it were, thinking situation, and we respond by gnawing at the bone that's thrown to us. It's wonderful to watch. And then somehow we are also shown that we are more than that. you can give me the bone back now. And that's always a sense of relief that seems to go with it, from the kind of tightness of trying to fix and solve and work out, to just a wider being in that situation. And each time that happens, we are reminded, each time it happens in some solitary lone synapse in our brain registers something as a possibility. And that's our practice for the rest of our life, or so far anyway. Can't speak for the future. That's how it seems to me in my experience. Tightening, loosing, tightening, loosing. And eventually, in some respects, the tightening seems to be less strangling. And the other, the blue sky self, seems to be a possibility more constantly. So, some of you have been looking at the koan about the dead snake on the road. It's the koan about the shortcut. The monk asks the Zen master, what about a student who takes a shortcut? And the Zen master says, it's a dead snake in the middle of the great road. How will you avoid it? And then there follows an interchange in which it's clear that the monk can't avoid it. But if he goes around the top end or the bottom end, or he ignores it, or he loses it in the grass, whatever it is, it's unavoidable. And that's how the self, attachment self, talks to the self, talks to itself. It says, here I need to find an easy way, or I need to find the correct way, or I need to fix this, or I need to become a different person, or whatever its particular narrative is, it can't escape it. It can't escape, it's everywhere. Wherever you are with the dead snake, you will lose your life. And even if you know it's a dead snake, it doesn't stop you getting terrified. Even if some part of you registers, you're still going to try and get around it. You're still going to be convinced by it. So what will you do? How will you just open out and see if something else is a possibility? And even just asking, doesn't matter if you find it, just the asking of that for oneself already opens, something happens. What's always, where am I going now? What interests me a lot, I'm sort of moving on a bit now, I think. Who knows? What interests me in the Heart Sutra, just this is now just thinking wise, information for the day, Buddhist history lesson. The Heart Sutra we chant every day is part of what they call the wisdom literature. Arose, as I think I said, in the Mahayana from about 300 BC onwards. And it's called the Great Heart of Perfect Wisdom. And the central figure in the Great Heart of Perfect Wisdom is the figure of compassion. not some figure of wisdom, you know. It's the figure of compassion. How does this work? And even inside the Heart Sutra itself, it's a bit difficult perhaps to refer to it completely because we have our own little version here for chanting purposes. But the original script kind of begins with the Bodhisattva of compassion moving through the space beyond wisdom, or wisdom gone beyond. And the figure of compassion then delivers this highly sort of philosophical treatise on form is emptiness, emptiness is form, everything's empty, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, etc., etc. No path, no Buddha, no everything. And then it moves into a mantra, which is not sort of wisdom language, sort of magic stuff. And there's a sort of strange, wonderful playing with this contradiction of head and heart the whole time. So that's what I was toying with during some sitting or other. And then I remembered Sasaki Roshi saying that he was the monk with whom I was ordained. Teacher with whom I was ordained as a monk. He said, when the West understand interconnectedness, they will understand the Buddha. That's what he said. I thought, okay, let's have a look at this particular issue through that lens. And this is what popped out. The sort of thing that I say every day probably. But let's go for it. Form is emptiness. Emptiness, one aspect of emptiness is just the sheer unknowable, stupendous, colossal, unintelligible, impenetrable web of existence of which we are a part. That there's nothing in it with a self-enclosed, self-contained life. Everything is part of, touched by, caused by, causing, just connected with everything else in some way that is too large for our brains to comprehend. Their genetic aspects, their physical, their evolutionary, their nurturing, their upbringing, their cultural, their climatic, their everything. Everything is just unholdable in any sort of self-contained way. At the moment we have that kind of awakeness, there's nowhere to hold, it feels. There's nowhere to hold, literally. Nowhere to hold. Scientifically, dare I say it, nowhere to hold. Spiritually, psychologically, nowhere to hold. Very frightening, very exciting, thrilling. But what that means is that everything that we regard as form, what they call the 10,000 things, this world, everything, us included, is simply an aspect of a moving web. And in that moving web, it's so we can't really, just taking opinions for instance, all judgments we make are highly provisional in the face of all that. Things we think are bad turned out to have unexpected consequences. Things we think are good, unexpected consequences. War brings out great courage and love. Apartheid brings reconciliation. Reconciliation brings strife down the road. There's just no pinning it down. We're looking for certainty. It's one of our shortcuts. I want certainty. You know, please, God, give me certainty. That's all I ask. Okay. And yet it eludes us the whole time. And in one sense, whatever happens is just happening. It's just appearing and disappearing. And all we can say is, just this is it. And this one half of a famous Sufi chant is then, nothing matters. That's part of it. But because everything's connected with everything in this incomprehensible way, it also means that everything that happens or doesn't happen is part of it. So philosophically, part of this, the uncertainty and unknowability is so radical that it kind of turns on its head, does a somersault. Because everything is connected in this way, we can't know it all, but it remains connected. So my moving of my arm changes the air in this room. The tone of my voice affects you. Okay, I get it. Okay. Emptiness is form. Okay. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. That's one little part of what that is about. And the second half of that great chant, everything matters. So in the Sufis, I don't know if any of you have practiced with the Sufi tradition. I had a wonderful time. I drank the best coffee ever. they required me to believe certain things and I had to back out. Anyway, but one of the chants was, everything, nothing matters, everything matters. Nothing matters, everything matters. So we'd go around right through the night, right through the night. Coffee. Isolated farmhouse in Yorkshire. Talk about absurd life. Okay. So, somewhere at the heart of all of this is this interconnectedness. That's the kind of key teaching. One aspect of that is intimacy. And the thing that blocks our experience of intimacy, or the realization of intimacy, because of course we may acknowledge it intellectually, but we've got to attain it. If we can attain it, then we can use it. It's our job. Okay, where were we? Intimacy. What blocks it is this, the dead snake on the road, you know, the attachment self. The attachment self's belief in itself and its problems, of course, and its limitations. It's an inherent defensive self-defensiveness. And while we're in that mode, the intimacy is not ours. The moment we open it is. The moment we open, I see all these wonderful faces here, you know, dozing happily. see the blue sky. You walk up the road in the morning, and everyone muttering. Suddenly you turn around and there's sun is lighting up the clouds, and the thoughts just drop away. Boom, here you are. In the spacious world, it's now my world. It's that simple. But from inside the attachment self, it's that impossible. The dead snake on the road. So what I've been calling the attachment self, so the name will change next year, is it doesn't matter that it's a false thing. We get caught there. We get caught. Whatever it is, whatever we say and think, we get caught there. And that's where our practice begins. And it doesn't matter where it is. If we've just forgotten and gone into some rapture or absent through trying to solve a problem or feeling bad about something we've done or whatever it is, doesn't matter. That's where we have to start. Because that's where we open into the intimacy. And that leads me to something I've been wanting to read for a long time. I thought that's pretty clever. Yeah. I didn't know if I'd ever get there. Yes, here it is. The story about Lin Chi. I mentioned the other day, Anton's friend. Lin Chi, who was the shouter. Lin Chi and Maureen. Anton. Okay. And it's given as a koan, but just take it as a story. It's also from the True Dharma Eye, which is Dogen's collection. Dogen was the man most associated with the Soto Zen tradition in Japan. He lived in about 1200 or so. And he went from Japan. He was a young monk in some other tradition, some other Buddhist tradition. And he went to China and he studied there. And on his last night, so the story goes, someone gave him a lot of koans, and he was so excited, and he spent the whole night writing them out. And this is the result. Okay. It's a story of attachment and starting again. Lin Ji sees Huang Bo reading a sutra. That's what the title is. Huang Bo was one of his teachers, also a famous early Chinese Zen master, quite an eccentric man in his own right. This is about, they lived, give or take, early 800s. And what's also interesting, just by the way, is that they lived in a time of enormous political and social instability. There were persecutions, there were famines, there were diseases. In some of the provinces, the population dropped by two-thirds. Anyway, very unstable times, a sort of urgency in the practice. Okay, Lin Chi joined a summer practice at the monastery of Huang Bo after it had already begun. The monks used to walk around and go from monastery to monastery certain times of the year. Anyway, he arrived at the monastery of Huang Bo after it had already begun. He went to greet Huang Bo and saw him reading a sutra. Lin Chi said, "I thought you were a true person, but I see that you are just an old master who is counting black beans after all." Okay. Strong attachment. Reading's bad. Okay. reading sutra especially bad. Okay. Bean counters, bad, bad, bad. Okay. Wonderful. And she said, I thought you were a true person. Da 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 da. But I see you are just an old master who is counting black beans after all. And Lin Shi stayed for a few more days, and then he went to take leave of Huang Bo. Huang Bo said, you were late coming to the summer training period, and now you are leaving early. Lin Shi said, I just came here to bow to you. Huang Bo hit him and drove him out. So the question there is, what kind of bow is that? Anyway, Lin Shi said, I just came here to bow to you. Huang Bo hit him, drove him out. After walking a few miles, Lin Shi began to have doubts about the matter. So he returned and completed the training period. I think it's a lovely story. So, big attachment. Reading's bad practice. Okay. Especially reading sutras, bad practice, not real Zen. Strong opinions. So strong, he was ready but casual about it, coming late, a sign of disrespect. And then he was obviously thought, oh, this is rubbish, I'm going on. And then Wang Bo just hit him and drove him out. Okay. And then Lin Shi thought, okay, maybe I made a mistake here. Okay. Maybe I made a big mistake. And so he just turned around and started again. That means great commitment to the path. Great commitment. And sometimes that takes great courage. And sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't. But when we're just willing to start again, it makes a difference. So our question really in our practice is just the willingness to see where we caught. Say, okay, silly me. And let that go enough to start again. And when we bring that kind of commitment to the practice, however often we may stray or go on a wrong, or what appears to be a wrong path, which of course right and wrong just don't even apply in this huge context, that something that appears to be unhelpful, we suddenly take from that, and it gives us great energy for our practice. Great mistake, great practice. No mistake, no practice. Okay. Sounds like they sense. Apologies for that. And then that world of intimacy becomes more part of our life, even if you know, we wander about it, and even if it appears to leave us occasionally, it just becomes a possibility. And the more we realize that, the more the world of emptiness and uncertainty and not knowing becomes a friend, the more the world of form becomes the place where we live our practice. As Desun Sinin used to say, you know, attaining enlightenment is easy. How do you use it is the question. So we come from retreat. This is our last full day. It's just wonderful that we're here. And we're now going back into the world. How will we use our enlightenment? How will we use the intimacy that we've met here. How will we use it in this life? And do we walk into a situation and all we've got to add is more opinions? You know, is that our contribution to this world? Can we walk in with something bigger? Something wider than the protagonists in a particular confrontation? Some of you are involved in tertiary education here and sit with these every day. Free education for all. Not free education for all. How do you go in without just adding, taking sides with those opinions or adding another opinion? Can you, for a start, just see, here's one opinion, there's another. Already that's a wider view. How can you find that lightning strike that will change the debate? Can you go in and say, for instance, we are so grateful for the opportunity to study. Now, how can we make it possible? It's koan practice. It's koan practice. Whatever you call it, it's koan practice. Okay, that means how clear and wise and compassionate can I be in every moment? Can I keep the intimacy of the boundless view? Can I keep the compassion of the face of each person in front of me, and their concerns and troubles and worries, and their possibilities and openings and solutions? And it's never-ending practice. There's no right way to do it. That's a dead snake in the road. It's just the willingness to give ourselves there. And if what we do is scorned, it's fine. Done our best. I have a relative who teaches the Alexander technique. Always worrying now about how to teach teachers walking. Walking, sort of a postural thing, and it's lovely. But always worrying, now should I teach it to the children in the school, and this headmaster doesn't like me, and that one I swore at and won't speak to me. Should I teach it at the old age home, you know, Zimmer technique? And just was so troubled by this, kind of completely stuck. You know, how can I teach people to walk? How can I do it this way and there's a problem, do it that way, there's a problem. Eventually I just said, just walk down the road. Just walk down the road. Wonder. So now, that's what she does. She just walks around the town like a mad woman. Yeah, and people say, oh, she looks so lovely when she walks. Okay, so that's our job. To just go in without the dead snake of fixing, of getting the result, of doing it right, of being a good person, or being remembered, or solving the problems, whatever it is. We just give ourselves. And sometimes we make big mistakes. And that the passion of making a big mistake out of great love will change people, will change somebody, will change something. They won't remember your arguments. They'll remember your fearlessness, your passion, your affection, your deep willingness to stand in their shoes and see the world through their eyes. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's just sit for a minute.